I'm very, very happy to see so many of you again from last night or from last year, and to be continuing with the class series that we're offering here, which will, of course, go through Sunday. We have interesting programs, and I hope many of you can keep coming. Each program has an entirely different focus, but all the pieces fit together. This path of self-realization is really like a tapestry where each thread goes together until you finally begin to feel how the whole cloth comes. The topic that we're talking about tonight is prosperity, which of course has to do with abundance in all levels, abundance of happiness, of health, of well-being. But the simple subject of generating money and how to have it or not have it is really what we're talking about. And it's based, let me phrase it differently. Swamiji has written on this subject several different times. There's a small book called Secrets of Prosperity, which is one seed thought for every day of the month. He wrote a short book called Money Magnetism, which is, like so many things that Swami Kriyananda has done, the words are deceptively simple. Swamiji took things that were so complicated and reduced them down to such sort of straightforward ideas. The way I've often described it is he takes you across the top of a mountain. You kind of skip across mountain peaks, and you only when you stop do you realize, you know, how much it's taken to get right to that point. I was reviewing Money Magnetism for this evening, and I'm just astonished by the ideas that are in there. So any of you who are interested in this subject, or especially if you're struggling with this subject, I really encourage you to get that book and read it slowly, not quickly. You can, because it's just a little book. You think you can be done with it in no time. And then also when Swami moved to India in 2003, the first work that he did here was he first called it material success through yogic principles. Now he calls it success and happiness through yogic principles. It's 26 lessons. And it's a whole year of study, and it's a big, hefty course. Trying to explain how subtle principles manifest in the material world. I also did about a year-long course on it, which if you go to my website, if you Google my name, Nayaswami Asha, it leads you there eventually. Almost everything I teach is posted online, and it's a free download. And this one I called it Manifesting Through the Power of Yoga. But it was straight through Swami Kriyananda's course, so I highly recommend this. All of this is by way of disclaimer, because an hour from now, you're not going to be able to walk out and be a millionaire. But maybe if you go back and sort of work with these, it'll help you a little bit. Now, what I really will just then try to touch on, and I'll draw from all of these materials because I've studied them all a lot, is just some basic attitudes and understandings about how you think about money from a yogic point of view. There's a book we have a series of books called The Wisdom of Paramhansa Yogananda. And one of them is called How to Be Happy All the Time. And here's the most interesting fact about that book. At least a third of that book, maybe more, is about money and the attitude that you have to have toward it, how you can generate it, and all of those things, which is his own practical recognition of how much of life begins to come right into a point at the question of having or not having money. Now, it's an interesting reality also because many people feel that it's quite inappropriate for spiritual people to talk about money. And being an American, I was speaking to an Indian friend today, and I said to him, now, excuse me, I'm going to be very American. And I carried on with the conversation. And he who had lived in America said afterwards, what was American about that? I said, I needed something from you, I asked you for it, and I wanted you to say yes. There was no no delicacy about this. We're just going to go right to the point. And the American attitude about money is very much like that. The Indian attitude, I know, is more, I don't know whether you would say it's more hidden, more delicate, more refined, more elevated. Let's just say it's different. But there's also a strong attitude that if you're spiritual, you shouldn't be talking about money. And even in materialistic America, people are very sensitive to that issue. You're supposed to be there inspiring them. You're not supposed to be getting money for your building fund or for your whatever it is. Now, I feel that this is all extremely misplaced. This, especially the idea that if you're spiritual, you shouldn't be talking about money. For this particular reason, I think money and our individual relationship to it is a deeply spiritual issue. And I'm a very good fundraiser in America. My husband and I, in the center that we've developed, we've skillful. He's a very good businessman, and I'm a very good communicator. My definition, my explanation of our marriage is he does all the work, and then I tell everyone about it. And so it works very well. I get more credit than I deserve, but it doesn't really. He doesn't mind. The whole thing works. But I've had a lot of times over many, many, many years, because Ananda has been built, again, of course, you know, it started in America, now it's international. But we've never had wealthy patrons. Spiritual works I know often in India are the good karma expression of people who've been gifted with a lot of money, and then they understand that one way to use that. And with all due respect, many people have gotten a free ride from their good karma and have gotten the idea in their mind that they don't exactly have to relate to the practical aspect of it because somebody else has done it for you. It's great if it works. In America, Ananda has never had that, and we've had to just come up, you know, dollar by dollar and day by day is how we've said it. And as a consequence, one way or another, even though I've never worked primarily for money, our spiritual path has had to be extremely practical, or else it wouldn't exist. Swami Kriyananda was 36 years old when he was expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship, YSS, on this side. That story is a fascinating story, but not the subject here. But the point is this. He was 22 when he met Yogananda. The day he met Yogananda, he was initiated as a monk and taken into the monastery. And the monastery was formal. He took vows of renunciation. He had a $15 a month salary. That was his life. He came to India later, and he always lived that monastic life. But then, because of complete misunderstandings, disagreements about what Master's mission was, he ended up being expelled from that and completely out on his own. He went back to live with his parents, who were well-to-do, but they were not inclined to support their 36-year-old son who had walked away from the family at 22. But he was living in the back bedroom of their house. He owned nothing. He had a few $100s in his pocket. He had been forbidden to be in touch with anyone who had been part of his life for all these years. So he was entirely alone, except for his discipleship. And from that, he built Ananda. Every piece of it. He worked and manifested every piece of it with nothing but his relationship to the Guru and his understanding of the teachings of self-realization. He'd never had a job. He'd never taken a business course. In fact, he was rather ostentatiously against all of those things. But he had Master's teachings and he understood how to do it. I commented to him when he wrote the Material Success Course, which was really, it's really an autobiographical story of how he did it. It's how, you know, how I went from rags to riches. I said, if you had been doing this for yourself and accumulating the money and the energy for yourself, this would be a world-famous story, rags to riches. But having done it for a spiritual work in which the force that created it is subtle, you know, it's people just sort of see it grow and don't understand that what he was doing is what anyone would do who wants to accumulate energy and, you know, make something happen. Because the simple fact is, and this is the way Master expressed it perfectly, every good, noble, or philanthropic enterprise sooner or later comes down to a matter of money. And he wasn't trying to be indelicate in saying that. He was just saying, this is the way the world is constituted. Now I want to come back to what I was saying. And then the second thing that Master said, which I think is really key to this conversation, he said, this is very interesting, the second greatest art to realizing God is to make money honestly and industriously. I mean, first is to realize God, second is to make money. I mean, this just takes all of our ideas about the spiritual path and about the material world, and it just kind of garbles them all up, doesn't it? Because we have this picture in our mind that, you know, and there's the ancient traditions of swamis who never touch money and all of these things, and you do have remarkable examples like Paramahansa Ramakrishna, who, you know, Vivekananda tested him by hiding a rupee under his mattress. And as soon as he lay on the mattress, Ramakrishna, he felt that he was being attacked and hurt, and he jumped up and wanted to know what was wrong with his bed because he could feel the vibrations of it. And then you have another self-realized master, Yogananda, telling us that the second great art after realizing God is making money. Ramakrishna can't lie on a rupee, and Master is telling us that we have to learn how to do this. Now, Ramakrishna had a different mission, and this is one of the reasons why you can't mix too many different teachings, because you end up with spiritual indigestion. But Master was also trying to create this, for Dwapara Yuga, an integrated reality between the material and the spiritual world. Because if you really think about it, how could the material world be anything but the spiritual world? I mean, like, what else would it be made of? You know, well, like, it all has to be a manifestation of Satchidananda. And the conditions of life that we find ourselves in, it's one continuous and consistent flow from our manifestation out into the material world and the what we have to experience here. And Swami Kriyananda created the Naya Swami Order in 2009, which now looks like it's an expression of Ananda, but he really created it completely separately from Ananda. He was one of the foremost sannyasis on the planet, and it seems self-evident when you travel the world and see confluences of swamis together. Swami Kriyananda was definitely a leading light. He felt guided by God that it was time to reform this, that so many of the attitudes and the rules of the sannyas order, for one thing, of the traditional swami order, nobody follows anymore. I mean, not touching money, not staying longer than 3 days in one place, all sorts of things. He felt that just a new order for a new age was required. The blue that I wear is a sign of that. I am a sannyasi like a traditional orange-clad swami with differences. It wasn't necessary to renounce my marriage. My husband and I have done this together. These are part of the Naya quality to it. But also part of the quality to it is to integrate the material and the spiritual. Swamiji writes in his book, A New Order, A Renunciate Order for the New Age, he talks, interestingly, a great deal about the appropriate attitude for a renunciate to have toward money. And this is bringing it back to where I'm saying, I think spirituality and materiality are exactly the same thing, and especially in regard to our money. Because the reasons why people can't make money are often the same reasons why we can't realize God. The reasons why people cling to their money are the same reasons that hold us away from having faith in God. What money represents to everyone is status, security, the capacity to fulfill desires, self-definition, self-worth. Gee, don't those sound a lot like qualities that we need to work with on the spiritual path? And one of the other factors about this is that many spiritual qualities are hard to get a hold of. And faith in God as a particularity, these are very subtle ideas, and we can spend a long time thinking about them. But thinking about them is not the same as actually beginning to reform the way the energy and the consciousness that we are flows through us. And I think Master addressed the question of money and how to be happy. I think Swami addressed it in the Material Success Course for another reason that I think is vitally important. And often when I am in a cycle of time, certain ideas become key to me. And I started this particular 8 weeks of classes and so on in Mumbai a few days ago. And I was trying to, because this is the second time I've come to India. This is the third time in the last year or so that I've come, the second time I've come on this tour. The first time since Swami passed in April. When Swami Kriyananda left for the infinite, however we want to describe him, a dear friend of mine, when her husband died, rather unexpectedly, people would say, as people do sympathetically, this is off the subject, I'm just enjoying this, "Oh, I'm so sorry you lost your husband," they would say to her nicely. She said, "I didn't lose him. It wasn't like my wallet that I left at the store," she said. "I know exactly where he is. He's just not here," is what she said. So I want to say we didn't lose Swami. We know exactly where he is. He's everywhere. But we lost the capacity to converse with him in the same way that we had. But there's a natural tendency when one has been in relationship to such a great figure. I consider him to be the only grown-up that I know, that I knew. Jokingly, I said once, you know, the only grown-up that we knew on this planet has now left the planet, and now it's just us. When I was in my 30s, another woman and I were traveling with someone. We were helping him. He was writing, was when he was finishing The Path. And we were in Hawaii, as it was. Somebody had given him an apartment there, and we were just tired of working, so we were going to take a little boat trip. I'm calling up for the tickets. "How many adults, how many children?" "One adult," I said. I started to say two children, but I realized when we showed up, they were not going to see us as children. So I said three adults, but I felt like I was lying when I said it, you know. But when Swamiji left for the infinite, dissolved his body into the infinite, I realized all of us had to think more seriously about what Master's mission really is. You know, not everyone I know in this room is a committed disciple, but many of you are. And those of you who aren't, who are just becoming interested, well, let's think about it. Because when a new avatar comes, he doesn't just come to just do the same thing. Even if he affirms ancient traditions, the reason an avatar comes is to bring a new reality. I was talking about Sri Ramakrishna, and his reality did not involve some of the things that Yogananda involved, but he was the one who first expressed through his own life that all these seemingly different paths are actually one path, different paths to the same goal. That was his extraordinary and at the time unique contribution. Well, Yogananda came with this east-west contribution, and I was speaking of it yesterday, so I won't go into it at length. But the spirituality of India and the practicality of America, and America epitomizes material success. I mean, I've lived there my whole life. I live in Silicon Valley. It's stunningly wealthy. I know that there's a huge amount of money in India, and there's wealth everywhere, but I'm just amazed and everybody just takes it for granted how much money there is there. People have earned it. It's not like it, you know, they didn't print it, although the government is now, but they made it. They made it with their own creative energy. But Yogananda really wanted that, and his foremost male disciple was the self-made millionaire. And his second foremost disciple was the self-made millionaire. Isn't that interesting? I don't think any of these things are coincidences, because I think Master wants us to become master of all dimensions. That's, you know, India used to be a very, very wealthy country. Of course, that's why the British came. The British came because they saw a pot of gold that they thought they could just take, and they very systematically took it from you. England rose in prosperity, and India came down. What a coincidence, you know. But when India was powerful and wealthy, it wasn't because of an abandonment of Dharma. It was because of the understanding that the spiritual plane is higher than the material plane, higher, more subtle than the spiritual plane. By higher, I don't mean in any sense like the material plane is awful and the spiritual plane is right, but the material plane is a lesser expression. And therefore, when one masters the spiritual, one should automatically be able to also master the material. You see? And when we think in our minds that I'm going to master the spiritual plane and I'm just going to ignore the material plane, this is where I say they're absolutely integrated, because it's energy, magnetism, the same abilities, and this is what Swami writes in Money Magnetism, the very same qualities that give you spiritual success can and should also give you material success. Now, you might not want to use them that way. That's a karmic choice. I mean, some people need to use them that way, but there's nothing averse to doing so, depending on your attitude, and of course, depending on what you do with what you acquire. If you're acquiring only for yourself, then you've squandered it. But nonetheless, Swamiji points out that anyone who can master the material plane, even if they do it for selfish reasons, will have developed mastery. And there was a wonderful story about Sri Ramakrishna when he was visited by a troupe of theater people, artists and so on, who were not considered to be a very high caste at that time. And some of the more orthodox among his followers objected to the fact that he entertained them. And he defended it, and this was his phrase. He said, "The god they worship now is art." He said, "But oh, they know how to worship." Meaning they know how to concentrate in a one-pointed way and do what they set their minds to do. And he said, and when that the object of their devotion elevates, they know how to worship. The implying that many of you who may look better actually have all of that yet to acquire. Now, many years ago, Ananda was struggling financially. You know, and yesterday Ananda was struggling financially, so it's never changed. Our joke is that we go bankrupt at a much higher level now than we used to. You know, when we used to lose money, it was hundreds. Now it's thousands, and we're still running the zero bank balance, but there's just more zeros after the zeros. But we were struggling financially, and we were all trying to understand how to make this work a success, which is what we're dedicated to doing. And people were studying everybody's teachings on prosperity in America. There's all these teachings on how to get rich. And I asked Swamiji, he hadn't, the books that he subsequently written, he hadn't written at that time. And I asked him I said, what is the secret of prosperity from the point of view of self-realization? He gave me one word, and that word was creativity, which I thought was a marvelous response. And he said, the secret of success, of prosperity, of manifesting, is if one thing doesn't work, then you try another. And if that one doesn't work, then you try something else. And if that one doesn't work, then you try something after that. And I've meditated on that a lot. He's since filled out that thought enormously. But what he's describing and what Money Magnetism describes are a few essential attitudes that when we start stepping into them, not only will prosperity on all levels become ours, but also we become correctly oriented toward life in general, which is what we really want in the end. Because, you know, we can earn all the money in the world, and when that last breath comes, that was our conversation last night, all of it is just gone. But what you do take with you is the consciousness that you have developed. And money is like the gymnasium, one of the ways. Now, the first thing that Swamiji talks about in that book, which is so interesting, is and it's the name of the book, it's called Money Magnetism. And he makes a very important distinction between the ability to acquire money versus the ability to magnetize money. And he points out, he said, and he's actually, without naming us, he's really talking about the Ananda community over the years. He said people who have very little nonetheless both accomplish and do a lot. And I have traveled an enormous amount, much more than many of my friends whose income and assets are much greater than mine. Is something burning? No. Okay. Let me find what I'm trying to say. Okay. The real power of abundance that we're looking for, whether financial or in any other way, is related to the word I was using earlier, which is the word faith. Okay. When we have faith that everything's going to work out, that God is taking care of us, that we're following the path that our master wants us to follow, then we operate in this world in a certain way, don't we? When we operate with anxiety, with a fear of lack, an uncertainty that things are going to work out, okay, then we're showing a certain lack of faith. Now, I want to say, and it's very important, the first phrase that Swami talks about in this book is the ability to attract, the money magnetism. The last chapter is you've got to be practical in your idealism. So I want you to know that I'm not going to be able to cover every base in this, but Swamiji does. But the ability to attract what you need is to understand that money itself, even though it feels like a fixed reality, is like everything else and more than many other things, a manifestation of energy. I mean, on a more subtle level, I mean, you hold a dollar bill in your hand. I love the association because when you travel and you're having to hold different currencies, it's so hard for me to see rupees as having inherent value. I'm used to American money and I subconsciously recognize the value of all the bills. I mean, it's great for the merchants in India when Americans come because it feels so much like play money. We'll just spend it so lavishly without the slightest idea of how much money we've spent, no matter how much you do the math. But it's not, there's nothing in the paper, of course. It's a flow of energy. It's when you have it, you can flow in a certain way. Now, we tend to think that money is just this fixed reality, that there's only so much of it, that I acquire a certain amount, that I get a certain bank balance. Now I feel secure. The first thing we have to dismantle, and this is everything that Swami has taught, is to understand that what draws everything to us is the force of energy that we ourselves are putting out, the quality, the quantity, the clarity, and the uplifted vibration of our energy creates a certain magnetism. This is the law of physics, isn't it? I mean, it's energy moves like this. And this whole creation, which appears so solid to us, of course, the rishis have always told us this, and now the physicists are telling us the same thing, that it's a giant field of energy. That's all we're moving through. Last night I was explaining that it's very important on the spiritual path to have the courage to follow through on every idea. And if, in fact, this world is a divine creation and it's just a vibration of energy, we have to realize that the laws that govern this universe are the laws of energy. They're not the laws of matter. There's a book that was recently published, which I haven't read and probably won't. It's called David and Goliath. It was published by an English author. And he's studied people who are success at business. And he's discovered how many men who are very successful entrepreneurs had learning difficulties or were dyslexic or in one way or another, their system didn't work properly. They appeared to be the ones who didn't have the power, and yet in the end they finally did. That side of it is not what I'm going to comment on. I read an article by the author of that book, and one group he interviewed, one person he interviewed was this couple who were part of the Mennonites in America, which is a kind of odd Christian but very serious Christian group. And this couple, their daughter had been murdered. That she left home one morning and was abducted, and a few days later they found her and she was dead. And she'd been abused before she was killed. I mean, it was the absolute nightmare, the biggest nightmare that you can imagine. From the beginning, this couple's response was, whoever did this to our daughter was a terribly troubled person, and we wish that we could help him to be not so troubled. And the author, of course, he went to talk to them because, I mean, such a response just stunned him. He couldn't imagine it. So he interviewed them. And now, I hope I can say this clearly enough, because it was an amazing point that he pointed out. He said, after talking to them, and he realized it was the theme of his whole book, even though most of the other people were wealthy businessmen, all of them understood that the real power of this universe comes from deep inside through our connectedness to the infinite. And even though, and this is where the David and Goliath comes from, you know, David was little and all he had was a slingshot and Goliath was the huge giant and had all the power behind him. David was connected to the source of power and Goliath was not. And so the point of that whole image is for us to understand, where does the power really come from? And if, in fact, this is an energy universe, as they're all telling us it is and demonstrating over and over again, then it is the quality of our energy that influences everything. It's not the wisdom of our investments and the percentage that we're getting here. Now, you have to be practical in your idealism, but it's not all that manipulating that really makes a success. It's the quality of energy that we have, because when the quality of energy is correct, everything you need is drawn to you. You see? Just as, I mean, many of you had the opportunity to meet Swami Kriyananda, not all of you, but many of you did. And he had, the word is magnetism. You know, you were with him, he had so much, the quality and the quantity and the clarity of his vibration was so, it was so powerful that it was like you could feel it. You were just pulled into his aura. When the first time I met him, literally, the first time I saw him, there was just something radiating from him that just pulled me right in to the reality that he was. He was operating the laws of magnetism. The spiritual is greater than the material, but the spiritual rules the material. So as people who have an understanding of that power, we need to approach every aspect of our life from the point of view of magnetism. What is the quality of my energy, and what would the quality of my energy attract to me? Would it attract to me, and if I'm always, the quality of my energy is always, oh, there's just, you know, I just don't know if I have enough, and I'm not really sure that this is going to work, and I really don't like what I'm doing. You know, I'm just going to have to go one more day and just go to work, and I really don't like this job. Like, just even on a perfectly human level, what do you think you're going to attract? If the quality of your energy is always coming out and you're constantly affirming, you know, just how unpleasant and how unwilling you are, like, what kind of energy is flowing through you? So Swamiji is saying to us here that money is a form of energy that responds to the kind of magnetism that we put out. And what we need to learn is, as he was saying, is the ability to attract what we need. Swamiji goes so far as to say, and he doesn't explain it in this book, but it's interesting, when we don't attract money, we must be doing something to push it away, because otherwise it would be coming to us. I mean, it's going to be going one way or another. There was a phrase that was very popular, poverty consciousness. And when we were really, really impoverished at Ananda Village in the early years, Keshava lived through those years too. And to be impoverished in America is not like being impoverished in India, especially when we all came from good families and could have gone home at any moment. So it wasn't. But on a day-to-day basis, we really had very, very little money, just basically enough to eat and pay the minimum bills. So, but there was this thought of that we had poverty consciousness, and I actually looked at that really carefully, and I realized, no, we didn't have poverty consciousness at all. What we actually had was what I changed to little rich kid consciousness, because we wanted it to come to us without our actually having to work. We didn't understand that nothing comes to you without your putting out magnetism. And then Swami writes again in the book, concentrated, clear-minded, and he adds another word for it. He said, your power is a combination of reason and feeling. And Swamiji has expressed this in much greater detail in other places. But intuition itself is calm feeling. Feeling is the foundation quality of the universe, which is to say that God is not dry and he's not an abstraction. It's Satchitananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. And when we go deep into ourselves, we do not find a neutral zone. What we find is this feeling of bliss. And our real power comes the more connected we are to that bliss. And so we can't take out of the equation of magnetism the quality of feeling. It was very interesting the way Swami puts this all together. And he said, and if we're really going to have the power to manifest, we also have to be deeply engaged on a feeling level, because that's where our energy comes from. This is the concept of feminine shakti. The woman has the feeling for it. Often it becomes emotion, but nonetheless, she's the one who moves the male energy, reasons, and then the female really wants it. The man thinks about the new house. The woman really wants it. And then the energy begins to move. I'm characterizing it, but you understand. But within ourselves, we can't just be dry about it. The heart and the mind have to be really working together for there to be really powerful magnetism. And it's not, feeling is not just desire. Feeling is enthusiasm and commitment and a sense that this is, that this matters, that I do this, that it really matters. And then that comes with that also is a deep faith. I was thinking about the success that my husband and I have had together in building the colony that we are now in. It's been 25 years. We've had time to get a temple, to build a school, and to do a few other things. And I realize how, without really thinking about it, we want it to happen. We feel God wants it to happen. We love what we're doing. We feel it's a privilege to serve. And this is, again, what Swamiji talks about. If the quality of your magnetism is, I'm trying to get it for myself, I need this for me, or even, and it's only slightly bigger, I need this for my wife or my husband or my son. Master made fun of that by saying, us four and no more. That's what he called it. And Swamiji, and I don't mean to be rude in saying this, but Swamiji said often a man or a woman justifies their own selfishness by saying, oh, I'm doing it for my wife, I'm doing it for my husband. But us four and no more is a little bigger than just me. But in relation to the power of the universe, it's not always enough, because it's still for the benefit of the world that I have identified with. Whereas the real power comes to us when we are relating to the greater reality. I mean, think about it. If we're just thinking of ourselves all by ourselves, and we're trying to make it, we're trying to figure it out, and we're trying to get our little corner of the universe just in order, get our little job just where it needs to be, and our promotion and our pension and everything just where it needs to be, how much magnetism are we going to have? I mean, we're just doing it ourselves. We're cutting it like this. If, no matter how humble our job may be and how unelevated the results of it may be, if still we're stepping into it in connection with the infinite for the purpose of what good we can create through this. You know, even a humble person who just cleans the railway station, if he's doing it out of his desire to make it beautiful for everyone, you can see it's an entirely different experience than if he's just cleaning it up. I was in a hotel in Mumbai, and I went into the spa, and I had been traveling, and this woman was going to give me a treatment, you know, what they offer there. And first thing they have you sit down is you sit down, and she washes your feet. And I almost just quit at this point, but it was committed, so I let her do it. She was supposed to actually put soap on my feet like this, and she just put a little soap and kind of just touched my foot with it, splashed it in the water, and then dried my feet. And I almost laughed. I thought, well, I said, I guess you sort of followed all the rules, put foot in water, put soap on foot, dry foot, you know, like that. But nothing. There was no relationship to what she was actually doing. And it was such a perfect example. I mean, she just didn't know any better, and she was lazy. But there you have it. On whatever level we're living on, are we just following the rules, or have we engaged our heart in it? Now, not everything is lovable. That's just a fact. And many jobs are, well, every job has some just big, unpleasant aspect to it. There's not a single job in the world that doesn't. The drudgery of it, it's always there. But magnetism comes when heart and mind are both united in one way or another. The more we are engaged, and the most powerful way to engage is to feel ourselves to be connected to a greater reality, serving that greater reality, being an instrument of that greater reality. Now, I can't, as I was saying to you, the reason I'm referring you to all the other materials is I'm really just introducing these ideas. But Swamiji then just talks about, you know, a whole lot of the other principles of our path, concentration as an example. You know, why is it that we don't have a great deal of concentration? Because we're always dividing our attention. Multitasking has become, actually, people consider it a job skill. You should have heard Swami comment about the mere concept of multitasking. How can you accomplish anything if you're not giving 100% of your energy to it? This is where he starts talking about these are the same qualities as the qualities of realizing God. I'm going to skip over and just go over to another part of this. Another key element to success and prosperity is a principle that you will immediately recognize, but is another one of those principles that we have to take very deep. This is the principle of dharma, of righteousness, and the power of righteousness. One of the mottos of Ananda is where there is dharma, there is victory. Where we are behaving according to righteous principles, in the end, it will all work out. And in fact, the whole impetus for Swamiji writing the 26 Lessons in Material Success by Yogic Principles was when he was, and you may have heard the story, when he was in the hospital. When he first came to India, he experienced just one health crisis after another. He nearly died on a kind of regular basis. In those first years when they were living in Gurgaon, they actually were so familiar with the hospital, it was like coming into a hotel. The same, do you have our regular room ready? And they had the regular room, and they had their whole routine. He just went in and out of the hospital in those first weeks and months. And you were here living with him, I remember. In fact, now that I'm thinking about it, when Swami was going to write the Material Success Course, Keshava came into the hospital room and took down the notes for the first. He dictated it from the hospital bed. I suddenly had that in my head here. But he was in the hospital there, Well, before I want to just give you another piece of it. I've never been assigned to India, but I've come in and out. And I was sitting in his regular room at the hospital during one of those first years. And a Swami from Rishikesh, I have no idea. I'd never seen him before. I've never seen him since. He heard that Swami Kriyananda was in the hospital, and he just made his way upstairs to visit him. And he was sitting on the side of the bed, and Swami was chatting with him. This was not when he was having a near-death experience. This was just a minor near-death experience anyway. The Swami expressed great sympathy. "I'm so sorry, sir, to see you so unwell." And Swami Kriyananda just so airily said, "Oh," he said, "don't worry." He said, "I am just doing the tapasya needed to establish my guru's work in India." Just like that. And that's exactly what he did. He just ran a lot of karma through his physical body. And so here we are. During those first 10 years, which, as I said, I just dropped in and out of seeing it, there was a lot of chaos. But I had such a strong feeling, which I actually discussed with Swami. I said, "You know, it really doesn't make any difference what anybody does, because he was sinking the roots." And now it began to matter later, and now it really matters what we do, because he's not here running the karma through his physical form. Now it's really in our hands. But in any case, when he was nearly dying in the hospital, a doctor came in and asked him. He said, "Basically, I can't make the money I need by honorable means." And Swami said, essentially, "Yes, you can." But he needed to explain to him how, which is where the whole material success course came. So I think, especially in this culture, it's less so in the one I live in, that faith in Dharma and the real invoking of to make money honestly and industriously, and to really have the faith that where there is Dharma, there is victory, it actually comes back to the David and Goliath that I was talking about. What is the greatest force in the universe? Is that force really the power of divine righteousness, or is it really money in your pocket right at the moment? And I have to stand back, because I have never been faced with a dilemma like that. I mean, that doctor said, "My son is in college in Canada, and I have to meet the bills." You know, so I don't know what that feels like. But in the tiny world that I've lived in, I understand that if we keep our magnetism where it needs to be, it will attract to us everything we want. If we disrupt that magnetism with lack of faith, lack of concentration, lack of uplifted energy, lack of energetic, heartfelt commitment to what we're putting energy into, lack of expanded sense of connectedness to other people's reality and to their welfare, then the quality of our magnetism is going to fall, and then everything else will fall after that. And for this purpose also, in the Christian tradition, the Christian and the Jewish tradition, there's a principle called tithing, which is not really an Eastern tradition, but it's a very interesting idea. And the idea is that everything that we have is given to us by God, and you might say loaned to us. I mean, witness the fact that no matter how much you accumulate, at a certain point you have to walk away from it. We only steward it. We don't own it in the sense that it lasts for however many years it lasts. And the opportunities given to us, we want to constantly affirm that those opportunities are also a gift from the divine, and to constantly remind ourselves of our connection to a greater reality. So the tithe means one-tenth. And the principle of tithing, it's very subtle, but it's very different than just donating money. The principle of tithing is that one-tenth of everything that comes to me doesn't belong to me. That's the commission I pay to God. You know, it's like I don't really own this life. I'm just using it. So if he gives me, I'll use American money, if he gives me a dollar, I have to give him 10 cents. If he gives me 100 pennies, I have to give him 10 of them. If he gives me $1,000, I have to give him 100. If he gives me 10 million, I have to give him 1 million. Now, the power of tithing, as opposed to just donating money, is that no matter how much or how little you have, a set portion of it always goes back. Now, how do you give money to God? There's lots of jokes, especially about Jewish people who tend to be somewhat, known for wanting to keep their money. Okay, the rabbi goes and he gets his salary and he takes all of it and he throws it up in the air and he figures what God wants he'll take and what falls back to the ground belongs to him. So, there's always in your life something that is the source of your inspiration. Whatever that might be, there's something that's the source of your inspiration, the way in which the divine reaches you. So the principle of tithing is that you return to God through the source of the inspiration, whatever that might be. Many people tithed personally to Swami Kriyananda. Some people tithed to the publishing company that put his books out. Others tithed to Ananda proper or to whatever church they belong to. But what you're doing, you see, by doing that, is you are constantly affirming, one, that God will always take care of you, two, that God is the source of what you have. And you just do that. Now, when you donate money, you say, do I have enough? Do I have enough? I think I have enough, so I can spare a little bit. Tithing is quite different. If it's a dollar, you give a dime. That's it. You don't ask whether it's enough. You just say, this doesn't even belong to me. And the act of doing that, and I love this, because people who have very little money say they can't afford to tithe because they have so little money. I mean, this is how people defend themselves. People who have a lot of money are so dismayed by the size of the check that they don't want to do it. But both sides are just saying, where does this come from and who am I? And I'm always advocating tithing, and I'm trying to explain to people, this has nothing to do with Ananda paying his bills when I'm standing in front of my own congregation and encouraging them. It has nothing to do with Ananda paying their bills. It has everything to do with how many of you have come to me and talked to me either about your impoverishment, the fact that you don't have much money, your fear about money, or your lack of faith in God. I said, this is a spiritual practice, because how you relate to the money in your hand is how you're relating to God. Really, it really is when you think about it. And these practices become so much fun. And there's tons of stories about people becoming so well-to-do. I mean, friends of mine, the first tithing check, 10% of their income that they wrote was $50. The most recent one was $1 million. Same 10%. They just, no matter what it was always just 10% right off the top of whatever it was. Just moving right through it. And they're perfectly conscious of, there are many other reasons they participate in a lot of these right principles. Now, you don't have to do any of that, but it would really be helpful to think about all of it. I don't just mean tithing, but tithing for me brings it all to a focus from the point of view of faith. Now, from the point of view of manifesting money, I've touched on some of those realities, but not all of them. But once you get into that flow, I've lived in this, and this is the last point that I wanted to make, I want to remember. When I was first living at Ananda Village, and with Swami Kriyananda in 1971-72, I ended up working personally for him. I was his secretary and his assistant for a while. And I earned $50 a month, which was a very small sum of money. And he would pay me out of his wallet. He would just open his wallet and he would hand me $50. I never had a bank account or anything like that, because why would I have a bank account with $50 a month? And I just spent most of it back, just to buy things. And I had a jar like this, little pottery jar, and I would keep my money in there. And even though, and Swami would play with us, He was teaching us many things. There's an area in California called Carmel, which is a beautiful little town, very, very beautiful by the sea. Swamiji always loved it. It's near San Francisco. And periodically he would take a group of us to Carmel. Carmel is very expensive. And we'd go out to dinner, and sometimes we'd go out to dinner, and dinner would cost like $25, which, you know, was a huge amount of money and was half of the money I made. Swami knew exactly how much money I had because he would pay me out of his wallet every month, and I had no other source of income. But I made a rule to myself, which I've kept to this day on a different level. If it was about my spiritual life, if it was about Swamiji, if it was about doing something that was right for me spiritually, and it wasn't insane, you know, I would always do it. And I would always know that the money would be there. And the weirdest things would happen in terms of that. And he would push us, you know. He would just say, oh, let's go out to dinner. Let's do this. Let's do that. And every time I put my hand in that darn jar, there was always money in the bottom of it. It was almost a joke. I didn't really even like to look. And I didn't want to have a clear jar. I had an opaque one. I'm not really saying that money manifested in the bottom of that jar, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did. Because I always knew that if I was moving in accordance with what Divine Mother wanted me to do for my spiritual well-being, and if I was not foolish, and I really have to add that, you have to be practical in your idealism. I wasn't just wildly imagining things. I was very restrained and very disciplined. But if it had to do with my spiritual life, that was the real power. And that's the whole secret. That's what Swami, in the whole course of money magnetism, he has much more, I mean, material success. But he succeeded because he said, I'm doing this for my guru. And if you genuinely are doing it for your guru, then he will take care of you. I published a book last year of miracles and answered prayers, and we called it Loved and Protect It. Right. I was just sort of, it just, my friend came up with that title, and I was thinking about it just this afternoon. What a beautiful title. Loved and Protected. And that's where we have to be. Then what do we have? We have the magnetism to attract money, which is incidental to spiritual realization. But the next greatest art after the art of realizing God. So, questions, comments? You were all pretty lively last night. Let's see if you have any thoughts.
I just want to compare what you have said in our Indian methodology. That is, Gujaratis are very successful businessmen.
Uh-huh.
They also believe in God.
Uh-huh.
And God, Lakshmi, Goddess Lakshmi.
Uh-huh.
They do puja,
uh-huh,
and prayers before starting any business.
Right.
And continuously during that business also, their success, they worship.
Right. Their thought
so
is always there.
There is a relationship,
yeah,
between business and God.
There has always been. And you see, India really knows that. And this is where the practical side of America, the spiritual side of India, but the understanding of how to use the spiritual principles to manifest in the world has been, I don't know if this is true, but this is how Swamiji and I were talking about it. It's like when the British came, they could take the jewels off the Taj Mahal, but the true power of India, which was the divine teachings, it was hidden in the Himalayas. And so the material things were stripped from the country, but not its true wealth. And now, though, it's time for India to rise. As Swamiji says, it's much too important to the world to remain impoverished. And this is what you see God is doing. It just countries coming right up. And I was saying earlier, and also India is distributing its culture around the world by the way that people are from this country are living all over the world, everywhere. It's your way of sharing that unique understanding. But the real gift that India has to give is not to become wealthy like America, but to become wealthy like India, which is to rediscover where true wealth really comes from. And I don't just mean what true wealth is, but where actual material wealth comes from. It comes from, and now it's understood as Goddess Lakshmi and so on like that, but those are symbols. And we're moving into an age when it's not that the symbols are not still true and even wonderful, but we can also access it directly. We don't have to just have the intercession of Goddess Lakshmi. We can understand who Goddess Lakshmi is inside of us and begin to work with that. That's what Yogananda came. In the West, the way he... You know, it's interesting, you see, because when Master came to the West, he did not bring Hinduism. He did not bring puja. He did not bring gods and goddesses. It's notable that he didn't. And when I first came to India, I dove into all of that because of reincarnation, because I recognized it and it touched my heart. But I had to really realize that my guru did not advocate that. He certainly didn't speak against it, but he knew it all. He could have brought it. And he didn't, because he wanted us to understand that spiritual power is in our own hands. And it's Kriya Yoga, and it's the shifting of our own consciousness. Not that those we can't enjoy and respect, but he wanted us to understand. In the West, we understood it as no dogmas, no priests, no necessity. But in the East here, it also means that we have to make the power from inside ourselves. We have to understand what it really meant to propitiate the goddess Lakshmi and then understand what that means internally. That's what Hindu Way of Awakening Swamiji wrote. That's about that aspect of it. But very interesting. Yeah. Anyone else? Any other questions?
So how do we understand very, very corrupt politicians?
The last chapter of their story is not written. And merely because they get away with it in this lifetime does not mean they have gotten away with it. The question of how do you understand really wealthy, corrupt politicians was asked by a man yesterday when he said, when somebody is born into really difficult circumstances, isn't that terrible? What do you think happens to the really corrupt politician who makes it through this incarnation? He doesn't get away scot-free. Sooner or later, that catches up with him. And he's working... Anybody who has power is to a certain extent working the same laws, because all power comes from the same place. But they're also breaking divine laws simultaneously, and sooner or later, the karma will shift in the direct... Because where there's dharma, there is always victory. But not necessarily tomorrow. Is that an answer, or you know, the only answer to that is bigger than one lifetime? Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
In the sense that there is, when you say that the higher plane being spirituality and the lower plane being the materialistic,
right?
In that, one would then say that they would have achieved the higher plane of spirituality, the corrupt.
They're operating. But that's what I was saying. There, anyone who has power, has the capacity to manifest, even if they're manifesting evil, they have understood something, because all energy is the same. They have understood something about concentration, magnetism, determination. You know, they have learned some things. But if they're misusing those abilities... Now, what I have to add is, Yogananda has a phrase, Master has a phrase, an autobiography of a yogi, that sometimes the karmic consequences of your own actions are delayed by what he called the thwarting cross currents of ego. Now, this is the way to understand that. Let's say there's a child of 12 who is really a bully, and there's a little child of 3, and let's say the 12-year-old is riding his bicycle and he sees the 3-year-old and he kind of turns his bicycle wheel and knocks over the 3-year-old and then laughs at the hurt he's caused and then just drives his bike away. The 3-year-old is maybe furious, but the 12-year-old has a certain amount of power that causes him to escape the consequences of his action. But just for the sake of the story, let's say the 3-year-old grows up. Let's say he becomes a banker in the local town. And let's say the 12-year-old grows up and he comes to the banker and he really needs a loan. And the 3-year-old says, there's not a chance in the world I'm ever going to give you any money. And it's like, it's caught up with him. But he didn't get it right away because he had a certain amount of power and he could escape it. So the corrupt businessman has learned a certain something. He has some skill. He's more evolved. The active, successful, corrupt guy is more evolved than the guy who's just sitting there. You know, he has to become evil before he can become good. This man is at least already evil. And so he's going to have to understand that he's misusing this energy by experiencing the consequences, and then he will be able to turn it to good. Yogananda said that Adolf Hitler had so much power, and Master actually said it wasn't clear which way he was going to use it, for good or for ill. And when Master went through Europe in 1935, he tried to see Hitler. He tried to make an appointment with him. Isn't that a fascinating thing? But he was thwarted. So he, you know, Hitler had it, and he wasn't sure which way he was going to go, Master said. And then, of course, he went very much toward evil. But he had power. So, and there's a story about Vivekananda, supposedly, when someone came to Vivekananda and asked him, help me to realize God. And Vivekananda, I don't know the truth of this or not, but this is what it was told to me, said to him, can you lie? And the man said, oh, no, I would never tell a lie. He said, can you steal and never get caught? No, sir, I would never do that. He said, well, learn to lie and learn to steal effectively, then come talk to me about God. And the explanation of that, supposedly, was that the man had no energy at all. And there was no way he could do anything. But whatever little energy he had was entirely self-centered. So he needed to cultivate that before he could learn to do something else. So it's complicated. And faith in God, to me, means this. If we haven't reached the beautiful, harmonious conclusion of the story isn't over. And that is personal. That's looking, if they're getting away with it, the story's not over for them. The story's not over for anyone. The story has a happy ending. Everyone ends up in bliss. And nobody really gets away with it because it's not over until it gets to that point. But people are so upset by the seeming injustice of so-and-so being born in difficult circumstances, but they're equally upset when the evil man gets away with it. And, hey, they go together, right? That's what happens, precisely. So you have to just see it, the whole thing, for what it is. But the thwarting cross-currents of ego make it hard to see. That's why instant karma is really good. When you do it today, you do it right now, and then you turn the next minute, and it hits you. That's really good, because there's no thwarting cross currents. Okay. Any other questions or thoughts?
How is the concept of materialism and spiritualism connected with the concept of destiny?
Well, in destiny, in the sense that this world is not random, that there are identifiable energetic relationships. It's not just that this happens randomly and that happens randomly. So our ability to manifest in this world, or our inability yet to manifest in this world, is all an expression of the complex karma that we're all working through, which you could call as our destiny. If you're asking about the question of free will, that's a slightly more complicated question, but cause and effect is self-evident in a smaller sphere, and we can extrapolate from that it keeps operating one way or another. But to be passive, we know produces nothing. So we can say, well, it's just my destiny, but you can tell that if you do nothing, nothing happens. This is where Master says you have to be practical. If you're, no, you're not doing anything physically. If you're capable of really meditating and not just sleeping, then you're putting out more energy than anybody's putting out. But a lot of times people say they're meditating and they're not. They're not putting out as much energy meditating as they would if they were working.
What I exactly meant when I asked the question was, let's see, the concept of destiny defines in a way that there are certain given things that you're going to be achieving in your life.
Right.
Now the concept of spiritualism says that the more you meditate, the more chances are that you will achieve nirvana.
Right.
Similarly, the concept of materialism is that the correct flow of energy, as we heard today,
right,
would reach, would take you towards material success.
You know, there's
now the concept is that in this lifetime, is it a given that you will achieve only this much and not more?
That's the question of free will. Let me just deal with one piece. It is not the given that the more you meditate, the more spiritual advanced you will become. There is no external definition. It's entirely internal. And it depends on the karmic condition that you have. You can't measure spiritual advancement by how much you meditate. You can only meditate spiritual advancement by how much you love and how free you are in your heart.
What I meant was, can you achieve nirvana in one lifetime or only?
The master says you can. In theory you can, but you see it's like this. If you can put out as much energy toward God as you have accumulated away from God. Accumulated meaning the total pattern of your chakras at this point and all the vrittis in them, the sum total of every action that you've taken so far is a quantity of energy. And if you can neutralize that energy, if you can transform that energy by the application of an equal force, then yes, you can become enlightened like that. Most people, I mean, nobody. You can't. That's why it seems to take time, because it takes time for us to learn the skills necessary to balance those karmas.
The level of spiritualism keeps on rising if you're the right path in every lifetime.
Yes, because more and more of the energy that you carry within yourself becomes free and upward directed.
There are some people who are born more evolved than
others. Obviously, because we've been at this for many incarnations. The age of your physical body has nothing to do with your level of advancement. A 2-year-old can be far more advanced than a 90-year-old. It's one continuous flow of energy from incarnation to incarnation. This is what the Bhagavad Gita says. Arjuna says, what happens if I try and fail? Well, you're born where you stopped. Just as simple as that. You're born where you stopped. No effort is ever lost.
I can answer is wherever you are putting energy, even for money, if you are connected with God, you are with Him. Wherever we are putting energy, even to earn money, but thinking of God, so we achieve both.
And I would put it this way: if you are working in the right way, with the right attitude, with the right skills, then that is what you take with you. And that is your evolution. Your evolution is that I've learned to concentrate, I've learned to give my heart to what I do, I've learned to think in terms of service, I've learned to feel connected. And if you've learned that by earning money, you've still learned it. And then you really have it. And just what Ramakrishna said, right now the God they worship is art, but they know how to worship. Right now the God he worships is money. But when he understands that money's not going to give him what he wants, he knows how to worship. He knows how to just turn his attention to the next, more elevated reality. We have to live through these experiences. We learn from experience only. Experience is what tells us. Now, I think that we have finished our evening. And I'm happy to stay, as I always am, to greet you and to answer other questions you may have. But I would like to call an official close, and thank you all very much for coming. I do hope to see you again in the next few days. God bless.